everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Peter Coppinger, the founder of Teamwork. We hear how he bootstrapped his company before raising $70 million and why he spent €500,000 on a domain name. Here's my chat with Peter. This was filmed in front of a live studio audience in Cork, and this was in association with my partners, the EAAS Innovation Fund.
Peter, welcome to the live version of the Entrepreneur Experiment.
Yeah, great to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, I always find it weird when people say that. But I pinged you, I DM'd you on Twitter. I was like, would you like to come on this podcast? And you were like, oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's mad. It's mad when you do these podcasts because usually it's just me and you or me and the person. And you never really imagine anyone listening. The live audience does add an element of eyeballs.
And thanks for coming out, everyone. I thought I'd be talking to an empty room. So great to have people here.
A home audience. They got to come out for you, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I want to start by asking you a very odd question. What's a Grand Council?
So my co-founder Dan and I are complete nerds, and our philosophy is have fun. Anything internal in the company, let's have fun with it, because life's too short. Let's have fun where we can have fun. You know, we do very serious work for our customers, but have fun where we can. So when we were organizing a get-together for all our staff from all over the world, which we started a couple of years ago, I decided we were going to call it the Grand Council. And I don't know if anyone knows where that comes from, but Lord of the Rings, the Grand Council of Elrond. We're just nerds. So yeah, we had our Grand Council last week. We had staff in from all over the world. And they were out in every pub in Cork City, tearing it up all week. And we use it, Dave, to kind of solve challenges. We bring customers in, we bring partners in. It's really good fun. But ultimately, it's to solve challenges and to move the business faster and to get us all aligned. And it worked. And we had one of the best ones ever.
It is a random question to start with, but there's a reason to my madness. I always chat to people who kind of know the guest. And the word, ask Peter about culture, ask Peter about teamwork culture. Even today, I was chatting to someone who'd worked with you previously, and they mentioned it was an incredible place to work. Talk to me about that. How do you go? Because I think it's one of the most overused buzzwords in business. People talk about it, but don't live it. How do you live it?
Yeah, like what is culture? You know, it is. It's a buzzword. You know, we want a great culture. But there was a time in our history, we were probably about 50 people. And Dan and I, you know, we were starting to have our first challenges with employees. And we were like, look, that person just didn't fit in or whatever it was, right? And we decided we had to write down what we wanted our culture to be. So we locked ourselves. So we rented a hotel room. We wanted to get away from the office, and rented an office in a hotel. And we locked ourselves away, and we had a really, really good think about it. And we picked some employees, and we were like, that's the type of behavior we want to model. And we came up with our values, and we hire and fire according to those values.
And how did you do that? Did you come up with a framework, a guidebook? What did you do it?
We just talked for hours about what type of company we want to be, type of people we want, type of people we don't want, type of behavior we want. What do we want to tell people when they come in the door? Are we really going to follow through? Are we really going to get rid of brilliant assholes? Guys and girls who are just brilliant at their job, who are bringing in revenue or getting things done, but are just toxic to other employees. And we decided, yeah, we are. We're going to follow through whatever it takes. We're going to try and have a good environment. And also, like, we don't like this thing that we're a family, because we're not a family. No, we're colleagues who work together. We want to respect and treat each other well, but we're not a family. We have a lot of thinking about that sort of thing, the culture we want. We also want people who move fast and are agile and don't get stressed. And when, you know, stress is going to happen in the workplace, it's inevitable. So one of our kind of key rules is don't let things fester. So we do this thing with all our staff. We have coffee with founders. We go through our values, because it's one thing to read them in a book. It's another thing to actually hear it directly from the founders, why we came up with these values and what they mean to us. And like, you know, we have a couple of golden rules. So the number one golden rule is don't be a dick. we've got feedback that kind of doesn't look good if we say that publicly on our website, right?
Probably won't put it on the sport.
That is actually one of our golden rules. The second golden rule is don't leave things faster. So like it's inevitable in any organization. Something's going to piss you off. Your boss, your work, the new rules, you'd miss the pay rise, whatever. But don't leave it fester. You have to have it out. And it's easy to say that. It's really hard to do. Mm. And so we keep reminding people, don't leave things fester. Because these tiny little things become huge issues in your own head when you leave them fester.
What's the mode for having it out, though? What's the healthy way to bring that to the surface?
Well, I think effective one-to-ones right throughout the company. So like when we started, we were a mess, right? And you get more and more organized. You hit a problem. Business is nothing but solving problems. you hit a culture problem, you hit a this problem, you hit a that problem, you adopt the company, improve the company, improve the product, you overcome the next problem. Along the way, you get more organized. One of the things along the way is we learned about one-to-ones and what an effective tool they are for this sort of thing. One-to-one with your team lead or your manager is critical, and it's the employee's meeting, not the team lead's meeting or the manager's meeting. And it's a chance for the employee to talk about the career and to talk about things that are festering for them. And if that doesn't work, they can always come to myself and Dan. Our door is always open. Mm. And there's another third golden rule, and I'll just three. And the third golden rule is never, ever, ever, ever argue over any sort of text medium or even give negative feedback over text medium.
I like that.
All right, because myself and Dan used to have blazing rows over silly shit, right? Like, I'd make a link blue and I'd come back the next day and he's turned it to red and we'd have a fucking blazing row over silly shit, right? And what we found over the years is if we gave each other abuse over an email or over text or over chat, it just always flared up out of control. If we actually just talked to each other and be like, I think you're a bit of a dick because you overwrote my work yesterday. And he'd be like, oh, I didn't mean that. It always was a thing of nothing. So it's so important to us. And we've seen this pattern again and again and again. And you see it in your personal lives. You know, you send a message to your sister or your cousin or whatever, and you don't put the smiley face on it. Yeah. And they totally pick you up wrong. And suddenly it goes from not to 100, you know. So anyway, pick up the phone, jump on a Zoom call, and it's a firing offense. It's that serious. It's a firing offense if you're not taking this seriously. So if you're there in a, you know, reviewing someone's repo, or, you know, you're just giving someone abuse on chat, or even if it's just being overly negative, just pick up the phone. And it's a much harder and braver thing to do. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do it in real time, just send a video. So I've done this. I mean, we all slip through the cracks every now and again. Like, our bugs got out of control at one stage, and I got really angry, and I sent a chat message going, fuck it, bugs are after getting out of control. This is ridiculous. And next day I said, lads, sorry, I was just like really stressed. You know, at the time, I shouldn't have done that. So next time it happened, I recorded a video. I said, look, guys, I just found these two bugs. They're really bad. You know, and like, our bug count's up to 180. We agreed we'd try and keep it under this amount. You know, please, please, can we sort this out? And that was received so much better. Mm. Anyway, culture is a thing that you're never done with. We're always working on it. And like, CEO is kind of like chief culture officer, I think, really have to take the lead. So anything that affects the mojo of the company has to pass through myself or my co-founder. So for example, if the people team try introducing a new policy, actually, this is an interesting one. At one stage, somebody brought two huskies into the office. We love dogs in the office, right? Somebody brought in their two giant huskies, and we've this kind of green artificial grass area at the back. And then there was about five other dogs in the office. And anyway, they all went out the back. And as it turns out, the two huskies shit everywhere, right? And everyone's like, we need a dog policy. We need a dog policy. I'm like, how about we don't have a dog policy? How about we just apply common sense going ahead? And actually, that's one of our things as well. We try to rally against, it's natural when a company gets bigger, bureaucracy creeps in. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, we need this rule, we need that rule, we need to do this thing, we need a policy for this. And we're like, let's go as far as we can with common sense. And we'll implement policies, you know, as a last resort if we have to. So I know, I think it's a huge part of my job. Anything that affects the mojo of the company, I take responsibility for.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish business who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the very best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to becoming more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. And if there's one thing that entrepreneurs want, aside from more money, it's more time. The local enterprise offices want to give that back. Their supports for competitiveness and productivity can help your business save time, money, and energy. For them, it's all in a day's work. So if you want to give your business the gift of time, decreased costs, and lower electricity bills, then go to allinadayswork.ie, take 2 minutes to fill out the form, and let your local enterprise office handle the rest. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy.
How do you keep it front of mind as you grow? Because you've grown into a huge company now. How do you keep that front of mind?
Well, first things first, I tell anyone on the leadership team, anything that affects the mojo of the company has to pass me and Dan. That's the first thing. Like, that's a rule. Like, they know that they, if it's something that affects the mojo of the company, like how we're going to run the Grand Council, we're going to do it, change up the format of the event this year. That's fine. No problem. But you got to run it past me. Because, you know, sometimes they just go too bureaucratic, or they miss the original intent of it, or they miss that, you know, we have a culture here and a history, and rituals are actually very important, that we maintain rituals in the company, the Grand Council, or whatever it is.
What are your rituals?
Talk to me about that. Ask me. Well, the Grand Council is
probably... Oh, you set it up. I got to go there.
All right, the Grand Council is probably the single biggest one. There's a ritual where we get a team of people and we sign up for our own product every single week. And we pick a competitor and we sign up for their product every single week as well. And we compare them side by side. That's a good ritual. There's a quarterly kickoff. And in the quarterly kickoff, we talk about where we were, where we are, where we're going. It's very simple. That ritual keeps everyone up to date. There's loads. There's rituals on every team. There's a leadership team. There's what we call an L10 meeting every week. It's a 90-minute meeting for the leadership team every single week. It never goes a minute over 90 minutes. It happens the same time every week. The start of every meeting where we've got a team of people together, we spend the first 5 minutes doing a personal update. So what we do is we go around and we say, hey, what's going on in your life? And you might say, oh, I went kayaking at the weekend. You know, that's good. I didn't know you were into kayaking. Next person says, I'm actually really stressed at the moment because I put my mother into a nursing home. And you're like, yeah, I didn't know that. Anyway, we go around. Everyone shares something. It could be a business thing, whatever you want to share. It just takes 5 minutes. But holy shit, it deepens our relationships with each other. It becomes such a richer work environment. So I do that now in board meetings. So in our board meetings, which are usually really stuffy affairs, right? I force them now. I do my CEO update and I'm like, right, let's do the ritual. We go around the table and it's unbelievable the connection it brings. It turns out that these investors are actually humans and they love their kids and shit. Who knew? So we're much closer to them now and have a much better
relationship. And you brought that in?
Yeah.
What was the initial kind of like feedback? What were the eyes around the table when you said that first?
I was just kind of... I knew it would be a tough sell. I'm like, hey, can you just humor me? Let's just try it. And, you know, it works really well in meetings. And like, let's just try it. And they were like, yeah, okay. And that first one went so well. The next one was like, hey, let's try that again. And now it's just a thing we do. It's become a ritual. And we're probably the only company that they do that with. But I think it's a really healthy thing that every company should do. Oh, by the way, we're like the Borg. Like, we rarely come up with our own great ideas. But like, we hear, we read and we learn and we listen. And whenever we hear a great idea, we're like, that's a great idea. We're going to assimilate that into teamwork. So we're constantly robbing ideas that are going to improve our culture or help us move faster.
How are you dealing with the hybrid world now? Are you hybrid? Do you do remote? Are you all in the office? What way is that now?
Yeah, because we make software that helps companies work online. We use our own software. It was never really a stress to us when everybody went remote. It was just like smooth sailings. Everything continued. We also were always flexible. We always allow people just work whatever hours make sense for you. You need to go pick up the kids. You need to get a haircut, whatever makes sense. Just, you know, just do it and make up the hours to us and we'll treat you like an adult. We'll expect you to think like an owner and act like an owner is the flip side of that. So that trust is important. So it was smooth sailing mostly for us. Now that we're back, we had this interesting strategy. We have a beautiful office in Cork. And we had a beautiful office in Belfast. And we had this really cool strategy of telling people in Dublin, hey, come escape the rat race. You'll earn the same money. You'll get to work in really interesting stuff. And you get to work in this beautiful office. And it was brilliant. For years, we had all these people coming out of Dublin. They were, you know, so when they got married and they were thinking about kids and stuff, they wanted to escape the rat race. We even had this cool website, escapethecork.ie, with this animated graphics and all this. And we were showing how much cheaper and better everything is. And it was a brilliant strategy. And then COVID fucked it. So now we're the same as everyone else. Everyone's remote and we don't have that thing anymore. And now we've got these expensive offices and nobody's coming in. So when you go to our office and any given day now, it's a ghost town. We've been debating, should we like mandate everyone back in? And it doesn't feel like us to do that. Yeah. So we're kind of leaving it at the discretion of the team leads at the moment. But we're bribing people in Tuesdays and Thursdays. So what we do is we do catered lunches in the office Tuesdays and Thursdays. And the car park's full every Tuesday and Thursday. And it's great to see a bit of life back in the office.
Where are we going with this? Because companies are really struggling. I chat to a lot of entrepreneurs. Yeah. Almost to a company, they're struggling with this. They can't figure this out.
Yeah, I don't have all the answers. I know you talk to one entrepreneur and they'll say, fuck that, everyone in a 50-mile radius, I want them in the office 4 days a week, I don't care. That's one extreme. The other extreme is just let everyone be remote. There's kind of truth in both of it. I mean, you can't beat bumping into someone in the office and being like, Mary, I actually watched that. I literally, this happened, this scenario played out last week. I met this girl in the office and I was like, hey, it was Jane. I said, Jane, that video, I happened to watch this video you did a couple of weeks ago last night. It's amazing. You came across brilliant. She's like, thank you so much. And as we were walking away, I said, by the way, are we releasing that thing? She's like, yeah, it's ready to go whenever you want to. I said, gotcha, throw it out, let's go. So that like 30-second interaction. Mm. You know, to recreate that, we would have to schedule a Zoom call, put a half an hour slot in, say your video is great. Blah, blah, blah.
And it's not going to be natural. You're not going to have that spark.
Yeah. And then, or even, you know, did you have a honeymoon recently? Yeah, and all this, like, you just cannot beat that. Or an opportunity for young people to show how good they are and go the extra mile or share.
So what's the answer? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? What do you think the answer is?
All I know is we're just going to keep doing what works for us. I think every different companies are different. Like, if you have a support team, you kind of need support people working together so that they learn off each other. And it's very hard to recreate that working remote. Same with a sales team. If you have a sales team, you need a high energy environment where, you know, when you win the big sale, you can turn around to your colleagues and be like, yes, I just landed a, you know, 50 grand deal. We have a big gong in the office, you know, and the rule is if you land anything over 50,000, you can go bong, and it's a bit of crack and people hear it in the background and stuff. Like, you can't recreate that energy remote. So at the moment, our sales team are required, I think, by their manager to come in 3 days a week, and our support team required to come in 4 days a week. But the rest of the company is kind of free. I think you can't mandate people to be in the office full time either. I mean, driving for an hour, just people that drive for an hour to get to work and drive an hour to get home, and doing that every single day is just wasteful and madness. And by the way, as a society, I think it's just tick that we all just leave our, as a society, we all exit out of our houses at the exact same moment.
It blows my
create
mind.
Create chaos. And then we're all stressed. And then we all leave our offices at the same time and cause chaos and stress and crashes and everything. We've got to figure out a way as a society that we stagger it over a couple of hours. I personally never travel during rush hour. I go in like 10 a.m. or whatever.
So bring me back to the start. We started in the middle. Bring me back way back to the start. You told me a great story upstairs. You did a game in cafe. Didn't see that on the bio.
Yeah, that was fun. We've had a long and journeyed history.
Was that your first kind of like startup?
I go way back, right? I knew I was going to be a software entrepreneur when I was 14 years old. And that's probably unusual, right? But I fell in love with computers at a young age. My cousin's had a computer. I was fascinated. I begged my mother to get us one. She did. It was between me and my two sisters. My two sisters hated it. They sold me their shared computer for two slices of toast.
good deal.
They got nothing for Christmas that year. And I taught myself what was cool about computers back then, it came with a little manual. And you're like, what? After you're finished playing the games, you're like, what is this thing? And you're kind of poking through it, and you're like, if I type in this thing, this ball starts bouncing around the screen. You're like, how did that make that happen? And I was just fascinated and hooked. Fast forward 2 years later, there was an Irish PC Mag magazine. I think it was PC Live or something. And they had a little disc in the front of it, and there were shareware games and stuff where, you know, you got a taste of game and you could mail order the rest of the game. So I started sending them in my games. And lo and behold, like, you know, you get 10 levels of some really crappy game. I mean, they're crap, like. But, you know, I'd be like, you know, if you finish the game, when you finish the 10 levels, say, hey, if you want to get 100 levels, send £5 to this address, right? And next thing, there's all these envelopes landing in the door. And after about a month of this, my mother was like, what the fuck is this about? What are all these envelopes coming in the door? And I was like, you know, I was always locked away in my bedroom. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's, I'm just selling software. Her mind was blown away that actually this thing I'm doing down in the bedroom was actually.
How did you feel though? Because that's mad as a young lad to get your first kind of major win like that.
It was awesome. I remember actually one of the highlights was, because normally it was just like, you know, their address and a £5 note, and I would just put it on a disc and send it back, right? But one time this lady wrote me like a really nice letter. And it was like, you know, I'm so impressed that you're a 12-year-old and you're doing this, and it's such a good man, and here's an extra fiver for you. And it was lovely. And I kept that for years, and I lost it now, but I should have kept it forever. But it was cool. I was always, couldn't wait to get to college, meet like-minded people and get going. Got to college, wasn't what I expected. People in my class had no interest in software.
What were you doing?
Well, I was doing computer applications in a CIT or MTU or whatever it's called now. I was very disappointed that nobody in my class really gave a shit at all. I wanted to be a game programmer and make millions. That was my plan. And I thought I'd meet loads of like-minded people. So disappointed. They didn't know how to turn on a computer. They had no interest. And they were being taught like the basics. And I had got college notes off other people. I taught myself C programming. I was miles ahead. And then the internet started happening, right? Around this time. And websites and all this. And I was fascinated, learned how to make websites and stuff. And then I started going around to every pub and restaurant in Cork City saying, hey, would you like a website? And they'd be like, a what? A website? Is that that WW internet thing? And so you'd have to explain what a website is, right? Yeah. And you know, most of them told me to get lost. One asshole said, what's your VAT number? Like, I'm just a kid, right?
I did the same thing. I set up a website and was advertising other businesses in the town. I remember I went to the local like Spar and he goes, no one's ever going to buy a fucking Mars bar on the internet, Gary. I was 15.
Track
was
him down. Like, we're like, yeah, prick, I'll show
I'll
you.
Show you.
Yeah.
I think I remember we had £1,000 at the time and it was like the most money in the world.
Oh, you were very expensive. I was like 400. You were £400. Huh?
We covered all Nina. Every business in Nina had a website.
Oh, class. But what's really interesting is, what did I call myself? Internet Solutions Ireland, ISI, right? And then one day I went into a bar and they were like, weren't you in here yesterday? And I was like, no. Then I went to the next restaurant. I was like, weren't you in here yesterday? And I was like, no. I'm like, what the fuck? Next one, same. I'm like, motherfucker, there's someone else doing the same thing. So I heard they were called Future ID, the other guy, right? This other guy was going around town doing the exact same thing, right? And he heard about me, I heard about him. We're mortal enemies straight away. I got one of these mobile phones that was a brick, you know, and I'm on the number 8 bus out to college and like, and this thing rings and it's some B&B in the Western Road wants to talk. I'm on the way out to exam, but I'm like, fuck the exam, I'm going to meet in the B&B. And it turns out it's a prank call from that asshole, right?
I love it.
Fucking winding me up.
I love his style.
So we meet, so mutual friend introduced us in college one day and we're like mortal enemies. And it's Dan, my co-founder, right? And within 30 seconds of talking to Dan, we were kindred spirits.
Really?
We were like, he was the only other guy, passionate for game programming, same thing, wanted to combine entrepreneurship and programming and create big things and do great things. And yeah, that's literally how we met. It's kind of a cool story, eh?
That's a great
story. More enemies to the only other guy I met with similar passion. So fast forward, like 2 years later, we dropped out of college. We were like, we didn't really want to do the whole website thing. We were just like, this is easy money. Let's go do this. And we started making these websites and we were like, we can churn out a website. So we can like, we're looking at 8 websites in a week. We can make it $1,000 a week. It wasn't so easy as it turned out. We called the company Digital Crew. There was another co-founder, Cormac. We were just up the road here by the GPO. We got an office. I think that was our second office. Listening to the Echo guy all day long. Started cranking out websites. From there, we started doing, someone asked us to make an e-commerce website. I literally wrote an e-commerce website in C++. Which is not the easiest thing in the world to do. I don't know if that means anything to anyone, but it's fucking hard. And then from there, we got a lucky break. We met someone in Pfizer who said, hey, could you come down and do a pitch for this internal project? They had an incumbent software supplier that did custom software for them that they were really pissed off at. And they had a new project and they asked them to bid on it and asked us to bid on it. And like they were probably, you know, 30, the other guys were probably 30,000. We were like, we'll do it for 500 quid. We got the gig and we put our heart and soul into it and we knocked it out of the park. And from then on, we had infinite projects from Pfizer.
Wow.
And we really scaled up. And like we spent probably 6 or 8 years as a consultancy.
Did that switch your focus?
Yeah, I think it was a huge distraction, right? Because it's a great way, I think, to start off your entrepreneurial journey because, you know, you've got to create a brand, you've got to create a service, you've got to learn how to pitch, you've got to learn how to do tenders, you've got to get your pricing right, you've got to learn how to interact with humans, which, you know, if you're a developer, isn't a natural skill. You've got to learn how to, you know, we made all the mistakes. We got screwed by one person. We weren't taking stage payments. We were like, deliver the project and get paid. Yeah. And as the projects got bigger, one time we got stung for 40,000 worth of work. The person literally fired, one person fired another person and wouldn't pay for the work. So we learned along the way to not do these things, take stage payments, to not interact with 20 people. We became a well-run services company. We doubled our prices, got even more, we got less busy and more profitable because we were the hamster in the wheel, like just running. And we weren't making progress. And the third co-founder just said, fuck this, I'm going to Australia. And it was just myself and Dan looking at each other going, what are we doing? We're working so hard and we're not making money. So we like doubled our prices. And none of our customers even flinched. They were like, yeah, we were wondering when you'd figure this out. Anyway, we did work for Aldi, for Lidl. We got really into the application space, doing all these applications. And we had really great customers, lots of university customers.
How'd you grow it?
But this is the thing, right? Like, you're the hamster in the wheel. And you can make the wheel bigger, but it's bloody hard. We always wanted to be product guys. And we had a few small products along the way, but they were never going to be more than 100 grand or 200 grand. They weren't going to be big. We were always looking for that breakthrough product.
Were you always trying to think of your own product as you were building these for other people? Were you always trying to think of your own?
Yeah, we were. And we had a few false starts. We also had the gaming cafe on the side. We used to, on Wednesday nights, go to a gaming cafe here and play games. And it was great fun. But they were kind of dicks. And we were like, fuck it. They pissed us off one night. And we were like, we could just do this ourselves. So we created a gaming cafe called Area 51. And for 2 years, we printed money. And it paid off. It paid off my credit card debts, and it was great fun and everything. But like, as Digital Crew became bigger and teamwork kind of took off at around the same time, it was just a huge distraction, the gaming cafe. So eventually we just left it go. How teamwork started is we had all these projects going on for our consultancy. And we had a whiteboard in the corner of the office where we listed all the projects, how much they're worth. You know, we had a little kind of red, we had stickers kind of for who's screaming the loudest, what the next milestone is, what the priorities are. And we did a review of this every Monday morning. And it was, we were like, geez, there has to be a better way to run a services company than this.
How long were we at it?
We're probably at it for at least 6 years at that stage, maybe seven. So anyway, we heard there was this, there was a couple of new online project management apps. And the biggest one that was kind of famous, we'd heard of it. We said, we'll give it a go. And after using it for a week, we're like, man, this thing's so basic. Like, literally all you can do is put in projects, put in tasks, and mark them as done. There's no subtasks. You can't attach a file to a task. There's no milestones. You can't assign tasks to multiple people. There's no due dates. And the whole thing was like so basic. We were churning out sophisticated applications for Pfizer, for Lilly, for all these guys every day of the week. And this stuff was child's play to us. And we were like, we could do a better app than this.
What year was this?
Right. But the thing is, the thing that really nudged us to do it was, I sent a support request to the company and I said, hey guys, we're really struggling. Is there any chance that you have due dates and file attachments coming in the next few months? And they sent back such a shitty response. Now, we'd always been really customer centric. We always went the extra mile. We bend over backwards and, you know, we do whatever it takes to keep the customer happy was kind of our mantra and mindset. And then I got this email and it was so ignorant. But one thing I've just said, look, I'm really sorry, we're not going to do it. But they were like, we're never going to do it. And we don't really care about your problems. They're your problems, not ours, kind of attitude. It was just reeking of attitude and it just pissed me off. And I remember going home, I lay awake all night thinking about this, going, fuck these guys. And I came into, we met every morning for coffee, a gang of us. And I met Dan in the morning. I was like, hey, I've been up all night thinking about this. We're going to take these guys on. He's like, let's do it. Fast forward 3 months later, we hadn't done a line of code on it because we're so busy with the client work. We're like, if this thing's ever going to actually happen, we're going to have to treat ourselves like a client.
Okay.
So that was kind of like the breakthrough epiphany. We're like, how are we ever going to get from here to there? Treat ourselves like a client. So we said Fridays, we work on our product. So we did all the client work Monday, you know, made a bit less money, but Monday to Thursday, we had a staff, probably 20 by then, right? So it was just myself and Dan would work on this every Friday. We couldn't wait for Friday to come around. We'd be in there first thing in the morning, tearing into the product. Then we'd work Saturday and Sunday and all Sunday night. And then we'd come in Monday morning.
What do you think was going to happen, though? What do you think you were building it for?
Yeah, anything that will get us out of the services trap, I think.
Right.
We weren't really thinking too far ahead other than we wanted to do product. Maybe didn't know if to, yeah, we weren't thinking too far ahead other than these guys are the market leaders and their product is crap. And we can make a better product. And we were able to dog food our own product, which was really good, and refine it. And then we put this thing on the internet. We had an internal bit of software called Teamwork CRM. And I don't even know why we called it Teamwork CRM. So when it came to naming our project management product, it was just like, yeah, we're calling it Teamwork Project Manager. So we launched it with teamworkpm.net, like the worst domain name in the world.
Yeah.
But somehow, it took 2 days later, we got our first sale.
And where did it come from?
Some lady stumbled. So this is the thing. Back then, you could be found on Google. If you launched anything, there wasn't as much competition, and somebody would search it, and you'd show up in the search results.
Do you remember what year this was?
They would just search project management, and they would find us in the list.
What year did you launch this product?
I would say maybe 2009. The date I remember is 2011, we launched teamwork.com.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
We'll get to that in a second.
We're going to get to that.
But it was kind of October, I think it was October 4th maybe. But yeah, we launched this thing, threw it on the web, gave each other a high five, went home to bed, back to client work in the morning. 2 days later, we got our first sale on PayPal. We just wired up a kind of quick PayPal checkout. And we're delighted with ourselves. It was $50 recurring, right? But $50 recurring is, you know, $600 a year if you can keep them. It's all right. But, you know, then we got another sale. And then we got another sale. And we wired it up so that in the office, which is, again, just up the road just by the GPO, every time we got a sale, we had Homer Simpson would go, pizza money!
Really quick break to thank today's sponsor. If you've been inspired by listening to The Amazing Business Person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the Local Enterprise Office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get the idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out your Local Enterprise Office on localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business today. Now, back to the episode.
So, like, you know, once a day you'd get, or once a week originally you'd get pizza money at some random time, right? And there'd be a client in the office and they'd be like, what's that thing? We'd be like, high-fiving each other. Go, ah, it's just a side project. And then pizza money started happening every day. Pizza money. And we're like, fucking sweet. And then it got to the point where it's like pizza money was happening every single day. And then it was happening twice a day. And then it was happening like
this. Was all organic?
All organic.
You weren't really pushing it yet.
Yeah. So back to Google, right? You could be listening. Like Google now is all ads, right? Mm. And it's kind of pay to play. And you have to have deep pockets to play in any of these markets. It wasn't the case back then. Like you could be scrappy startup and you would be listed on page one or page two and you get found. That's not really true anymore. I mean, rarely do people go to page two and they kind of look at the ads, and the ads used to be on the side.
Yeah.
So Google used to have the search results, ads are on the side, nobody looked at the ads. At some point Google went, yeah, we're just going to blend the ads in here. So Google are kind of evil, they kind of changed the game, right? But yeah, we were able to compete back then just on that. And then word of mouth was huge for us, so people were referring. But pizza money started happening every moment of the day. It was awesome, but like we had to turn it off. First world problems. So then we were in a situation where we started working 2 days a week in our product. And then we started working 3 days a week in our product. And then we're like, how do we get all, like, we've all got all these customers, but we don't really want to do it. How do we get from these customers? And, you know, we don't want to drop the ball, or, you know, we've had them for years. But how do we get to work on this full time? That's our passion. So we said, we tried running the two businesses in parallel. That was a mess, didn't work at all. So
why not?
We actually found a guy, there was a guy who worked for us, and we said, hey, I won't say his name, but could you run this part of the business for us? And he's like, yeah, sure. And like, well, you know, we'll give you a share of profits and everything else.
He was going to run the old part.
He would run the services business, and we'd run the product business is the idea.
Right.
And, you know, fast forward 2 months later, and we get getting irate calls from people who've been working for years saying this guy's a disaster. Actually, I remember going over to have I just got like an earful from a customer, and I went over to have a word with the guy, and he was in the office next door. And when I approached his desk, I was like, can we have a word? And he's like, yeah, yeah. He's staring at the screen. He was watching fucking Judge Judy. I'll never forget it. While he's meant to be working, maybe this was the problem.
It's probably the first sign.
Yeah. But we said if we could get the business to 30,000 MRR, I think. We thought there's enough money coming in that we can safely kind of get out of the...
It's 30,000 monthly recurring
30,000 monthly recurring revenue was kind of magic. Fear. In hindsight, I think that was too high. I think we probably could have made the shift at 10. We probably waited too long or too cautious, safe maybe.
Why do you reckon you waited?
Oh, I don't know.
You'd staff at that stage.
Do you know what's interesting? Like, my co-founder, Dan, and I, like, I'm always the kind of visionary saying, fuck it, let's go, let's do it. And he's always the, you know, let's just make sure we get this right. Let's, you know, wait till we're here. So we also have that that balance, I suppose. He balances, I'm like gung-ho and I'll fucking destroy everything in my path, and he'll calm me down. And, you know, only one of my ideas out of 10 might be, actually be a good one, right? So it works well that way. But anyway, we eventually found a company in Cork that we had done some work with previously called Granite.ie. And we said to these, they were services company just like us. We said, hey guys, would you take our business? And they're like, yeah, of course we will. How much do you want for it? And we're like, no, just take it. Just take it. And they're like, no, I have to give you something. And we're like, no, just all we ask is that you don't drop the ball with these customers. That's it. Just do not drop the ball. That's the number one thing you could do for us.
Why'd you not sell it?
It was more important that they didn't drop the ball. we knew that this thing was going to be big for us.
Right.
The product. So like services business.
So that was the price of your reputation?
Yeah. Yeah. It was more important that we look after customers. And we worked with them. We literally went to every one of our big customers, sat down with them, introduced them, did a warm handover. A lot of our customers were really skeptical. Mm. And to their eternal credit, Digital Granite, or Granite Digital, they took the digital part from our name. We were Digital Crew. They did an unbelievable job. And today, they're Ireland's biggest digital agency. And they're now branching out into New York and everything else, and they're doing fantastic.
That's cool.
So I think that's kind of cool. That so then, our, then we were able to go full-time at Teamwork. The next major milestone is we sorted out this awful domain problem. So teamworkpm.net. I was in, we'd reached out to the guy who owned teamwork.com. We'd sent him an email. You can track down their email address. And it was just somebody squatting on it. And we said, you know, we'd send an email saying, hey, you know, we'd like to discuss purchasing the domain. And then you just get back literally an email with a link. And you're like, what's this? And you click it and it takes you to a website and it lists all these one word domain names that have sold for obscene millions. So remember insure.com, 25 million, pets.com, 20 million, sex.com, 16 million. And we're just like, all right, we get the idea. And there's a list of 20 of these. So he's just telling us to fuck off basically, right? But one day I'm in.
Had you, I'm always curious how this happens. Had you going, hey, we'll buy it for like 20 grand. And he just sent you the link. Or how do you approach buying something like this?
Just that, right? So I'm in a pub across the road, well known in Cork, called The Brogue. And I was there with a friend. And I know it just entered my head. I was like, the other person had gone to the bathroom or something. And I just thought, I really wish we had that. I know I'm always thinking about work, right? Never switch off when you're an entrepreneur. So I sent the guy an email and I said, look, final offer, we'd buy teamwork.com for $50,000. What have we got to lose? And the guy instantly shot back an email, must be in America, with three words that I'll never forget. Same lowball offer. And I was like, what a dick.
So did you know who this guy was?
No, just had a name. I was like, for fuck's sake, give me a real price. So he instantly emailed back, I'd consider $675,000. I'm like, oh, I'm drinking my pint gun. Oh. So like I convert that to euros, it's exactly 500,000 euro. I'm like, all right, I check our bank account. We had exactly 530,000 in our bank account. We'd always been pretty frugal, so we'd been saving up a bit of money. And I thought about it, drank my pint a bit more. And I said, sold. Let me just consult my board, as if I had a board. And
I'm getting nervous just hearing this story.
I rang my wife, my now wife, and I said, she knows I'm out drinking. I just said, I just bought something for €500,000. And she's like, what? Come home immediately. So then I come home from work the next day and she's like, did you tell him? Did I tell my co-founder, Dan? And I'm like, I couldn't do it. I bottled it. I, all day I was trying to like find the perfect opportunity to talk to Dan.
And I just how do you start that conversation?
I say, you know all that money we saved up? Yeah, it's gone. So the next day I was determined. I was like, right, that's the first thing. I'm just going to do this. So I got Dan and our CFO and I'm like, right guys, we need to talk. And I said, look, we have an offer. Didn't say I've done it. Literally contracts are on the way, right? We've got an offer to buy teamwork.com for 500,000 and we have 530,000 in the bank. And I think we should do it. And as expected, both the CFO and Dan were like, I don't know, man. It's all our money. I don't know. I mean, we could get two Maseratis instead. And he's like, I don't know, man. And I knew this would be the reaction.
Why did you want it so badly?
You'll hear it here now, right? I pulled out my my secret weapon was my Martin Luther King speech. I was like, I have a dream. I was like, look, the worst thing we could do is be 80 years old and looking back with regret. That's the worst thing that could happen here. I said, look, let's say we buy it and we blow it. We can always make the money again, right? But we don't want to be looking back with regret. And yeah, we could wait a couple of years, but like in a couple of years' time, the guy could be looking for 40 million or 20 million again, right? This opportunity may pass us by and may never come again. And co-founder Dan thought about it for 10 seconds. He said, fuck it, let's do it. And we did. And it was the best thing we ever did. There's something in SaaS called the long, slow SaaS ramp of debt. So it's like companies start and they're just on this slow growth trajectory and they have no breakthrough kind of moments that propel them forward and they're all just tipping away and like they're never, just most companies don't break past 2 million, don't break past 5 million. When we launched this, we launched in January 2011 and all that changed was our domain name. and it hockey sticked our growth. Literally hockey stick on the strength of the domain name alone. Because you think about what it gives us like a, that one word .com gives you instant credibility. And you can imagine, you imagine two people talking in a bar and they're like, hey, we use this product at work, what's called teamworkpm.net. Or they can say teamwork.com, which one are you going to have more credibility in? Which one are you going to remember in the morning and know where to go and know that it's something in tech? So just on that alone, one of the things we always use to get as a startup is like, how do we know you guys are going to be around in 3 years' time? Especially when you're an unfunded startup. Mm. That kind of instantly went away and it gave us a lot of credibility.
Do you reckon the domain had that much power?
Absolutely, yeah. Branding and positioning are some of the most important things we've had to learn in our entrepreneurial journey. So like making the product is actually probably the easiest part of the whole thing. Positioning the product, distribution, brand awareness, all that is hard. And then the most hard thing is the entire people management side of scaling a business. Mm.
So what happened next? Do you hockey stick the growth? Do you attribute that directly to
the 100%, that was literally the only change. Hockey stick the growth. Then we got to the point where I was still like a developer. I still am a developer. I love software development. I always will. I'll always be contributing to teamwork in small ways. I think Ray Nolan on your podcast elegantly described like there's a beauty to software development. There's an elegance in it. You don't need to be a genius for it, but there's something beautiful about getting an algorithm out of your head and seeing something magical happen on the screen that influences millions of people around the world and you made it happen. The whole thing is beautiful. But
I've got to ask you one sidebar before we go on. How do you pay a stranger $500,000 on the internet? What is the process of doing that? This just struck me there. I was like, how do you actually just send that Revolut over 500K? How do you send a stranger 500K and know it's actually going to give you the domain?
Just stuffed in an envelope.
Flew to Miami.
It's interesting. It's like, obviously, we've never done this before, but there's a thing called escrow for exactly this. So there's services out there that will take your money and act as a middleman. Will confirm that both sides are happy, and only when both sides are happy will release the money. And they might charge you €500 for the privilege, depending on the size. And this guy has sold hundreds of domain names, so he was able to advise us. We did background checks and a bit of Googling, I should say, to figure out that this guy is real and everything, and he seemed pretty legit.
Did you ever find out how much he bought it for?
Oh, he bought it for like $20. Like, this is the fucking sickening thing, right? There was a time when I was in college when there was all these people like just buying domain names. And I was like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, they're never going to make money. I wish I...
Just bought loads of domain names.
Loads of domain names back then.
So then what was the next step? Because you're off, you're running, you're a serious player now. The hockey stick is happening. How many of you are in the business at this stage?
I don't know. I'd guess 20 or so. But there was kind of interesting thing that had to happen, right? So I'm a developer, my co-founder is a developer, and we're just heads down developing all the time. And we put in some staff around us and stuff, but mostly we're just developing. And that's okay when you're a small startup, but there was a time I actually went to, we built our second product, right? We love building shit. So I'm like, let's build a second product, even though that was madness in hindsight. We should have focused on the one, right? But we built a help desk product, Teamwork Desk. I went to New York and I worked literally 12, 14 hours a day constantly, heads down in code, developed this product more or less solo. Towards the end, I got two guys in to kind of help me with the thing, but like we worked unbelievably hard. And we emerged 6 months later with this lovely product and had a great time in New York as well for the 6 months. But I met Oisin Hanrahan there. I was there actually.
Incredible guy.
But it was really good fun. I loved it. It was brilliant. But when I came back to Ireland after 6 months, the business was on fire. There was all these communication problems, culture problems, lack of alignment, little issues that had crept in all over the place. People didn't know where we were going, what the vision was. And I kind of like after observing this for a couple of weeks, I had the epiphany. Oh, shit. I'm the CEO. I'm the CEO, but I'm the CEO on title only. I'm like, I've been acting like a developer. And that's why there's these fires all over the place. And I think that epiphany had to happen or we would have gone nowhere. I realized that if I don't actually change my mindset and actually be the CEO the company needs, that we're going nowhere. So I kind of downed tools for a while, figured out what our biggest problems are. As I said, business is nothing more than solving problems. Solving your biggest problem, one after another, figuring out what your problems are, thinking about them, putting creative solutions in place, solving them.
How did you tackle that transition though? Okay, I'm a developer now, but I'm going to be a CEO. How did you bridge that gap?
So whenever I hit a roadblock, it's a study mode. And like that's common for entrepreneurs as you learn more. But just, there's a very common pattern that entrepreneurs go through. Visionary entrepreneurs are kind of great at coming up with ideas and all this. And they tend, when they hit a roadblock, they tend to kind of go into study mode. That's exactly what I did in hindsight. So I started reading books. I think if you're an entrepreneur and you don't want to read books, by the way, you should just give it up and go get a day job. I once met an entrepreneur who said, I'll do whatever it takes to be successful, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And then he asked me some basic questions. And I was like, you should read this book. He asked me some other basic questions. You should read this book. He asked me some other basic questions. I was like, give him some answers, but you should read this book. And he was like, man, I don't like reading books. I was just done with that guy. You know, or if I give advice to a startup and I say, you should read this book, and I meet them 6 months later and they haven't read the book, they're dead to me. You
it's
have to read books.
The impact you can get for 10, 20 euros
absolutely
in your life. You're getting someone's entire... their life often, and all their life experiences,
all their wisdom,
for 20 quid.
It's in a book, unbelievable. And audiobooks, just as good, right? But what's not just as good as those things that kind of condense the book into snippets? I've tried them.
I don't like them.
They're not as good. Or reading, you might say, I follow 5 podcasts. That's not going to cut it either. It's okay, it's an inspiring podcast.
We can edit that out, don't worry about it. That's definitely never making the actual pod. Anyway,
you can do podcasts for learning about books and read the books for learning, right? But yeah, I went in study mode and just overcome one problem after.
How long did that take?
It's still going. it's never ending, right? And I keep getting sucked back into the development world because I'm like, there's a problem there and I can just fix it myself faster than asking someone to do it. It's something I struggle with every single week.
And how are you funding this business? Because you've just spent 500k on a domain name. So how are you funding this? Was the MRR increasing or how was it going?
Yeah, we were completely bootstrapped or self-funded, whatever you want to call it. So we had I think this is a good model. I mean, we had the services business to begin with. We had enough money coming in from that we could build our startup, got the startup to a good place that we could work full-time at it. We were always frugal. So we always lived within our means and saved up. That's where we were able to afford the domain name. Not afraid to make big decisions as well. I suppose when we bought the domain name as well, we had enough money coming in every month to cover our expenses.
Right.
So like it wasn't that we were going to be stuck the following month, even if we emptied our bank account. And that's the way we operated. We just operated as a profitable bootstrap company forever. And then over the years, the project management space became saturated. I mean, there's 545 project management apps now.
What?
Yeah, and there's something like, I'm guessing, but I would easily guess that there's 20 billion invested in the entire space, So the place has become saturated. There's loads of competing products, And there's products that have come out of nowhere from our perspective, have gone from 0 to 100 million in no time. And we're kind of looking at each other going, should we take money? And every now and again, we'd be in the pub and we'd be like, should we raise money? And we're like, no, fuck it. Investors are evil. I once told a room full of investors in Dublin that they're all evil and I will never take investment. And then we took investment 2 years ago. And the reason we did that is exactly this. We're like, we only get one shot at this and we don't want to be looking back with regret again. And we also think there's an opportunity. We kind of decided to niche down to service companies. Instead of being project management for everybody and every type of company in the world, we said we were looking at who are our best customers. Like they're all service companies, which makes sense because we built.
And what do you mean? You say service companies? What was that?
Professional services. Any company that charges by the hour or by the project. So you got law firms, IT service firms, web developers, all of the above. Professional services. So that category loves us and always did. And we're like, they keep asking us for these interesting features that are kind of very kind of niche, right? Such as. Budgets or retainers or recurring work or profitability analysis or this thing called utilization rates. You have these staff and your kind of job is to utilize them as much as possible. So you're kind of aiming for a 70 or 80% utilization rate.
Yeah.
So there's all this stuff that the rest of the world doesn't care about.
Yeah.
So we focused on this and by listening to our customers, we've kind of evolved from project management app to a PSA, professional services automation app. And we realized that in this space, there's nobody really doing a great job of giving service companies what they need. And we were like, we could actually be the guys to own this. We could be really big if we nail this. And that is the thesis behind the investment. The other thing is when you're self-funded, you can get so far. And I think it's definitely the way people should go, by the way. I'll come back to that. But there's a point at which you're not going to get the best people in the world working for you as a self-funded company. So, for example, we now have an amazing sales guy, amazing head of sales. He's unbelievably good. He's got the office in Denver, travels all over the world. He's an inspirational leader and he gets shit done. He's unbelievable. There's no way he would have worked for a bootstrap company. Not a chance. Because he wants an exit. He wants to make millions. So to get someone like that to join you, they'll only join a funded company and they want skin in the game. And they want to know that there's some sort of chance of a liquidity event in the future.
Mm, makes sense. Yeah. At what stage did you know it was the time to raise?
We antagonized over it and flip-flopped on it. And we'd be out for beer, myself and Dan over in Boston one night, remember? And we said, fuck it, let's do it. And in the morning, we're like, fuck that, we're not doing it. And we were like constantly doing that. In the
for
end,
how long?
Years. I mean, back and forth for 2 or 3 years, flip-flopping on this. But just before COVID, we said, screw it, let's do it. We just felt the time was right to kind of, you kind of reach these ceilings where you kind of feel like you need some kind of shake-up to get to the next level. You know, be it the .com or putting in a sales team or solving your West Coast problem, but there's always kind of a cliff. And it just felt like the next evolution to push us through.
What was it like raising cash after the bootstrap for so long?
What was good about it was start of COVID. And I told my wife, look, and we had a young child at the time, I said, look, you know, next year you're probably not going to see me because I'm going to be like traveling and I'll be going over meeting all these VCs. Apparently this is the done thing. And you go and you pitch and you're traveling everywhere. And COVID happened. It was brilliant because I just stayed at home. Zoom call, next Zoom call, next Zoom call, next Zoom call. We did these fireside chats. So I did 50 fireside chats. You kind of like, there's a process where you suck them in. You do these kind of teaser chats. And then, you know, that whittles the 50 down to, say, 40 express interest. And then they're probably talking about you internally in the company at that stage. So, you know. So then you, from 40, you do a kind of deep demo. So you've got to do loads of kind of deep demos and let them ask questions. And then from there, they've got to express interest. And then there's a kind of more formal process where it is before business.
How much were you looking to raise?
50 million. Oof.
How did you get to that figure?
No fucking idea.
Sounds good.
No idea. I don't know if there was a lot of science behind it. Yeah, maybe it was about 50 million feels right. I don't know.
I love the honesty, to be fair.
Yeah, no, I cannot remember. My CFO will be watching this. Go, fuck's sake, there was science.
All the charts we had, yeah. Peter, come on.
I don't know, 50 million just felt good. I don't know.
That was a bizarre time in the world as well. Like there was,
it was, yeah.
For a frenzy almost at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you piggyback on the back of that?
Not really. Yeah, everyone says that to us. So you would assume there's a project manager in apps. Actually, one of our biggest challenges in a world where there's 550 apps and they're literally happily, they're not, none of them are profitable, right? And they have billions invested in them and they're saturating the market with ads. Mm. In a world like that, it's very hard to stand out through the noise. And that's probably one of our biggest challenges. So you might have the best product in the world, but it's not about the best product in the world. It's about the best product in the world with distribution. So that's another reason why funding kind of becomes essential. You need to break through that noise and have differentiated marketing. It's a whole interesting topic in itself.
How long did it take to raise the cash, start to finish?
6 months, I'd say. It's a process. I mean, we got an advisor. I was like, we don't need an advisor. I met Des Traynor. And I said, hey, we're thinking of raising cash. He said, come up to Dublin. We need to talk about this properly. And I said, what was it like raising cash? He goes, it was easy. You just say you want cash and they give you cash. I was like, all right. So I go back to my board and I said, apparently you just say you need cash and they give you cash. And they're like, no, that's not how it works. So Des and Owen had a very different experience to me.
They're a unique
group. Yeah, yeah. People thrown cash at them back then, I think. But we, you know, I was convinced that we had to get a banker. In hindsight, the process is fairly simple. We probably could have done it ourselves. I think if we were doing it now, we could probably run a process fairly easily myself now that I know how it works. I don't think the banker does anything that magical, if I'm honest. Sorry, bankers, if you're watching this.
What did it feel like then when you closed 50 million? Like, that's a huge astronomical.
Well, here's the interesting thing. When you raise money, the first time you raise serious money, you are an idiot if you don't take 20%. That's the first thing. So for years, people were kind of like in the industry, were wondering, what's the done thing? Does it look bad if I take money? It absolutely, I can tell everyone in this room, if you ever raise money, take 20% for yourself. You deserve it. And they'll actually respect you more for knowing the right thing to do. And if you don't do it, you'll never again get a chance to take that money out of the company because you have other shareholders though. So you get one chance at doing that, right? And they will respect that you know what you're doing, right? So we were always, myself and Dan were always going to take 20% of the 50 million. And in the end, we got offered 70 million. And they said, you can still have 20%. So I was like, oh, holy shit, I like this. So yeah, we took the 70 million. Now, Ray Nolan said this when he on the podcast, like, you should probably never celebrate raising money. You know, it's a moment, it's good, you achieve what you want to achieve, right? But actually, the world of pain starts then. Because you're now on a timer. They want a return within X years. They have a guaranteed return, and you've got to scramble. You've got to deploy that capital. You've got to get going. And you can easily make mistakes. I mean, we definitely made mistakes. We hired really fast. We definitely got some hiring wrong, and we had to backpedal and undo the mistakes. I met the CEO of a company called Sisense, a really, really powerful guy, Amir, a couple of months ago. And one of the things we got wrong along the way is got some of our hiring wrong, or executive hiring wrong. If you get that wrong, you get the wrong executive hire, they have the wrong next level hire, and there's the wrong next level hire, and it's a whole mess, and you have to undo it, right? And we got funding, probably let it go to our head a bit, probably went too fast, and we had to undo some of that. So there's lessons learned. Amir was saying to me that the level of detail he goes into when he's hiring the executive, he explained it to me one night in a bar up at SaaS Society last year, and I was blown away. It was a masterclass on how to do executive hiring the right way. And he would rather nobody in a chair than the wrong person in a chair. Mm. Anyway, lessons were learned along the way.
So I want to talk in a little bit broader now about the Irish ecosystem as well, because I know you have some kind of ideas on that. How can we improve the Irish ecosystem? How can we improve, you know, the world for startups? Like, we met 8 great startups today. How can we make the world a little bit better for them?
Okay. I love this. I did myself and Dan had a good think of a couple of years ago. We could sell. And we set up for life. We don't have to slave away what we do, right? And have all the stress. But what do we really want? And one of the things I hit on is I want to make Ireland more sassy. What do I mean by that, right? So, like, there's just not enough SaaS companies coming out of Ireland. And I think SaaS, software is eating the world, right? And SaaS software as a service within that is eating the world the most. I observe that there's just not enough SaaS companies coming out of Ireland.
Why?
I would love to change that. I think it's mindset, it's ecosystem, it's support, it's systems, there's loads, right? It's not leveraging our diaspora. I think there's so much more we can do. If you compare us to Israel are about the same size. They're a little bit bigger than us. I think they have 8 million people. We have 5.2 million people. And they are known as the startup capital of the world. Startup nation. There's books written on how amazing their ecosystem is. They are pumping out thousands of startups, like serious amount of startups. And they're taking over the world. And their companies are going big. And they're staying big. And they're staying based in Israel. And they're contributing unbelievable amounts to the economy there. And like us, they're an island nation. And what I mean by that is all their neighbors want to kill them, so they can't sell to their neighbors, right? And they have nothing going for them. They have no natural resources. But yet, they realized back in the 80s that we got to create an ecosystem here that is going to generate wealth. And they put a lot of smart systems in place. And my theory is that, in general, I like to copy what works and try and invent what works. I mean, there's a model there that works. I think there's smart things they did. We don't have to copy everything they did, because they didn't get everything right. And I'm not saying I like all their policies or anything, but I think they got a lot right on the entrepreneurial side of things that we should copy as a nation. Mm. So
what are the couple of key things you'd install straight away?
Couple of key things. Ooh, one of the big things is Enterprise Ireland do a good job, deserve a lot of credit. I'm not gonna bash Enterprise Ireland at all. They've been good to us. But I think the model is wrong. I think the model of taking equity in companies in exchange for an investment is just the wrong model. So what they do in Israel instead is they have the innovation authority that does loans. And they get 8,000 applications for loans a year, and they grant 3,000 of them. And as long as you're something in kind of high tech, they will give you a loan almost no questions asked. And the loans are such a low interest rate that doesn't have to be paid back immediately, that it creates this environment where people will just give things a go. There's startups spinning up all the time. And then from an investment point of view, investors can easily buy out the government's low interest loan. So an investor can invest in five companies, and then the ones that look like they're working out, they can buy out the government's investment and double down on different companies. So it creates this like frenzy of an ecosystem where there's all these ideas. And I think that's what we need to make as a nation, because at the moment, like Enterprise Ireland are kind of like vetting different ideas and saying, that sounds like a good idea, or that doesn't sound like a good idea. That's not the ecosystem we need. We should just create an ecosystem where like there's all these crazy ideas that are just given a chance, because, you know, Dropbox sounded like a crazy idea back in the day. And Airbnb sounded like a stupid idea. Like nobody would have funded that shit. And look where it is now, right? We need to just create this environment where these crazy ideas can thrive. And actually, I go further than that. I think we have to go right back to the schools. So like, we don't teach entrepreneurship in schools at all. Like, it should be part of the fucking curriculum. And I'll probably get killed for this, but I would swap Irish for entrepreneurship any day of the week in my book. Probably get murdered for that. But I think we need to teach entrepreneurship in schools, and we need to teach programming in schools. And one of the key things I would love to get across to girls in particular, I have two young girls, 6 and 5. I think girls should know that the original programmer was Ada Lovelace, was the original programmer, was a girl. And up to 1984, I believe, 50% of all programmers were girls. And then something happened that there's charts I've seen where like the amount of girls who were programmers just dropped off a cliff from 1984 on. And there's this mindset that programming is a job for the boys, not for the girls. I mean, we can turn that on its head as a nation, but we've got to bring it right back to the schools, and we've got to inspire. So, and we think we need to teach that entrepreneurship is a viable, tech entrepreneurship in particular, is a viable career path. And it's where you can make serious money. And you don't have to be a nerd like me to do it, right? You just have an idea. You can work in the ecosystem. You can work in sales. You can work in marketing. But like, give entrepreneurship a go. And I think we need more role models. We're going to right back to the schools.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you made a great point there. You can never tell at the early stage, because often the idea you start with is nothing resembling. You're a perfect example.
Yeah.
The idea you had at the start doesn't resemble anything you're doing with teamwork now. Like, so it's what
But
we need to incentivize people to start.
Yeah.
Not like kind of go, it's almost like gambling. You're kind of picking 10 winners
definitely.
And kind of going, okay, that one might work.
I'm going to ask, I hate all these incubators that take equity out of a startup. Like equity is your magic. You only get 100 magic beans, right? And these startups are taking some of your beans away. I fucking hate that. Like if you go through NDRC or any other accelerator, you should be coming out the other side with a loan. There should be no equity coming out of that company. There's lots of vultures floating around the scene. And we also shouldn't create this environment where people are just, what did Ray Nolan call them?
Grantrepreneurs.
I thought that was hilarious. Like, there's a lot of grantrepreneurs around. Like, that's not good either. The other two things we need to do is leverage the diaspora. So we've all these like super successful Irish people all over the world, and we don't leverage them, right? And we're starting to see some initiatives with Enterprise Ireland doing more to leverage the diaspora, but there's so much more we could do. Israel is famous for leveraging their diaspora. They are all supporting the mother nation. We have all this goodwill out there in the world, super successful Irish people, and we're not leveraging it. And I would say as well, SaaS companies could be like in the same town. I'm sure there's SaaS companies here in Cork that I don't know. We're not helping each other scale and grow. We're not creating this environment where we're all in it together. It should be us versus the world. It doesn't matter if two of us in the same category, because the bigger opportunity is out there. I would love to see that change. There is, if you're in software, by the way, there's a thing called SaaS Network Ireland. It's we're trying to get SaaS companies to help each other and to scale. And we've got some amazing speakers in. We're trying to keep it so it's not one of these kind of nonsense industry events where people just go and don't learn anything. You know, we got in some unbelievable speakers. We had Des Trainor speak recently. You know, he gave that nugget of wisdom that you should just assume AI is going to transform your industry and then prove it to be untrue. It's a kind of safe way to go forward. You know, it's brilliant nuggets. We had April Dunford, who's the world's most renowned person on positioning of companies, in for a talk as well. And the idea is that every SaaS company will make themselves available to people who are not as far along on the journey as them.
Perfect. We're going to open up to the floor to questions in a couple of seconds. First, we're going to do a quick fire round with you.
Okay.
You mentioned books. What book should every entrepreneur read?
Just one?
Give me a couple. Go on. Your favorite and then a couple others.
All right. If you're starting off, there's a book called The E-Myth. And The E-Myth kind of, it's brilliant. Kind of first page one, it kind of says, you should build a company to sell. we all think of our companies as our babies, right? And it just kind of dispels that myth straight away, right? And it's just a brilliant book to kind of ground you in reality. Once you're scaling up, there's a book called Crucial Conversations. And at some point you're going to have, you know, a scenario where you've got to have tough conversations. You're probably going to be avoiding them. Maybe you've outgrown one of your employees and their role or whatever. Maybe your co-founder isn't working out, whatever it is. This book is just brilliant on how you deal with that in a real honest way. It really helped me along the way. There's another book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. Mm. It came out 10 years ago. It is the best book ever. It is fucking hard.
It's recommended a lot. It's a great book.
It's so hard building and scaling a startup. It's just problem after problem. This gives you perspective. It's meant to be hard. I mean, you're playing for big stakes here. So, yeah. And now there's a book called that really helped me out. Kind of as you're probably when you get past 30 million or so, there's a book called Rocket Fuel. And it outlines that the common traits of a visionary CEO is that, you know, it lists all their good traits. And it kind of sounded like it was talking exactly about me. But then it lists all your bad traits. And it sounded like it was talking exactly about me. Like, you know, can't pay attention to someone unless they make their point in 10 seconds. And I was like, guilty as charged, right? And it was all these common traits. And it's just, it's kind of reassuring to know that it's common. But what it recommends you do is get somebody to be your kind of your co-pilot. Your COO, or they call it an integrator in the book, but it's someone who's going to filter out all your crazy ideas. You'll have like 20 crazy ideas, and only one of them will actually be the one that's going to drive you forward. And that person kind of acts as a filter, and that kind of acts as a stabilizer and helps coordinate your ideas. Often visionary CEOs don't have good follow-through. They're good at coming up with the ideas. They're good at kickstarting projects, but they're not good at keeping it going. They get bored and they move on to the next thing. And that integrator can kind of stabilize the ship and keep you focused and hold people accountable and stuff. It's a brilliant book.
What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Change management. I think, again, a typical CEO, you're like the bull in the china shop. You know, you don't realize that your decisions have massive impact on other people in the company. And it's hard and it's kind of tedious, but you have to do it.
What's something you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Sleep, travel. I've never been to Australia. I always thought I would when I was young.
Don't give up just yet.
I'm going to get there, but I'm going to do it properly. I'm constantly thinking about teamwork, thinking about entrepreneurship, time, money, health, sleep, all above. It's hard.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
If you gave me 10 million euro, I'd probably start another startup on the side.
You're a true degenerate startup.
I'd give you some shares. I have a similar idea to Ray that I think there should be SaaS in a box. Like there's every SaaS company, all these SaaS companies are rebuilding the same stuff, right? So a login mechanism, a logout mechanism, account management, price plan management, the ability to upgrade, to downgrade, to add users, like all this kind of like boilerplate. And we're all kind of recreating the same thing over and over. And then there's that 10% that's unique to every app. Like nobody's given us the boil. There should be, I think interesting, like we all used to manage our own servers back in the day. And then AWS came out and they said, we'll just do that for you. And that pain went away. And we're like, that's way easier. I think you should have the same thing for all that crud. And then you build your product on top of it. Nobody's made it yet. Ray Nolan had the same idea. So either myself and Ray are going to work together on it or we'll be competing.
Well, mortal enemies turn best pals. I've heard that one before. Yeah. Might work out. If I give you 1 million euro, you're only invested in one person or one company. Who is it?
Well, that's hard. Myself. Is that an answer?
100%. We've had that a few times and I love it every single time. You've already told me which company you start in the morning, so I'll ask you the next one. What do you believe other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
I think startups, in all honesty, are a young person's game. And I know that's probably not palatable to hear, right? But when you can live off ramen noodles and you can pivot, that's a lot easier than when you've got dependencies and stuff. I also believe that, you know, you shouldn't, as a startup, aim to raise money. And that is very controversial in today's day and age when everyone assumes to get something off the ground, you have to raise money. I'd rather you work in McDonald's as a side job and do your startup on the side than go raise money straight away. I believe there's only a couple of scenarios in which you should raise money. So one is you've already reached a tipping point where now you want to scale something up, right? So you've got some traction, you've got some revenue, you're in a good place. And I'm talking like 5 million mark at least, right? And you believe that you need to scale up by getting, you know, sales teams in North America, whatever. That's a good moment to scale, but not to get from the get-go. Another one is if you got expensive hardware requirements. So maybe you're doing DNA testing or something, you just have expensive hardware requirements. That's a good reason, fair enough, go get investment, but that's rare. And the third one is like, if you're a moonshot or nothing, which most things aren't. If it's like Airbnb, right? It's either going to go work or it's going to crash, and I'm not going to spend the next 10 years of my life figuring out which one it is. That's rare that you're in that category, but that's a good option as well. And I'd say the other thing is, I mean, if you're over 30 or you have a mortgage or kids, then yeah, fair enough, go raise money, even though in the long, you'd be better off if you didn't.
What's something in your personal life you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
If I'm honest, I'm not really that materialistic or into brands or anything. I do love my Tesla. I really, really love it. Trying to get a new right-hand drive Model S. Apart from that, the second I got money, I bought a place in Portugal. And I take the family over to Portugal a few times a year, and we'll absolutely love it and get away from the miserable winter now and again. So I think it was a smart move and a good buy.
Beautiful. Like your founders, actually enjoy the cash they've raised. I think it's important. What's your final piece of advice to every founder or aspiring founder listening?
Read books. Go for it. I meet too many founders in Ireland that are focused on Ireland. Like, there's more opportunity in Birmingham than there is in all of Ireland. There just is. And the answer you always hear is, I'm going to start in Cork and then I'm going to go to Galway and Dublin, then Manchester or whatever. I'm like, no, just go fucking straight to the world stage. That's the beauty of SaaS products, is you can sell to the world instantly, and on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. You can make yourself look bigger. That's another thing I often see. Like, you should make your website good. Just copy someone else's website. But like, you know, it's a low bar. You know, it can really transform people's perception of your company or product to just have a good website. I see loads of websites where people love putting up an About Us section about, we are the founders and there's two of us and my dog. And it actually just makes you look, have a look at your website objectively and think about what makes us look small, or flip it, invert it, and be like, how can we make this look like we're a 50 person company? I see that mistake all the time. And the other thing is just tenacity, just go for it. If you don't raise money as well, you can pivot, and there's a million different ways to make money. The other thing is, like, a lot of people are seeking their like a $50 million idea, right? There's a thing called the stair-step technique in software. There's a website called Software, there's a podcast called Software for the Rest of Us, and it outlines this really good technique. It's just like, build your first product. Your first product is going to be a one-page website that sells like a course or downloads a PDF or something simple. But, you know, you learn how to make a product, how to sell things, how to have a checkout, how to do simple branding. And then once you get that working, you build your second product. It might be a little bit more involved. Then you build your third product. And then you, by your fourth product, you're building something that's going to make you a couple of million. But it recommends you go through these steps rather than go from naught to 50 miles an hour.
Beautiful. Peter, that was an immense podcast. Thank you so much. Where can people learn more about you and about teamwork?
Look, I want to make Ireland more SaaS-y. I will happily give any SaaS company, Irish SaaS company, advice. Do anything I can do to help you, just reach out to me on LinkedIn is probably the easiest. Google Peter Coppinger, find me on LinkedIn.
What was that domain again?
Teamwork.com. Teamwork.com if you want great software for your services.
Well, I think we learned the power of it. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Peter.
Thank you.